to do is just take us back a little ways to understand better where we are and propose a framework of thinking about the current phase of transitional justice as transitional justice globalized. So the term was one that that I found useful 2 decades ago with the change in Argentina, which is where I'm from, and the transformations that later happened with the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And in proposing this terminology, my aim was to account for a very self-conscious construction of justice, but one that was associated with a particular politics, periods of political change. And in particular, given those examples, those instances following oppressive rule, in the one case military juntas and in the other communist rule. Now we see an entire field of inquiry. I think the conference reflects it. Extraordinary scholarship, centers, research institutes, a field that ranges from the scholarly to the practitioner, and in between, numerous interest groups and advocates, and it's also ranges from law and jurisprudence, ethics, economics, psychology, theology. So how should we think about the developments or what ideas might connect both these scholarly and practice agendas? And I appreciate Phil's opening. Well, one way to think about this is to appreciate the road traveled. So I was brought into this with a debate at the Council on Foreign Relations, and it was a debate about punishment versus impunity in the Southern Cone. And at that time, we were looking chiefly at Argentina and Uruguay. And the issue, the debate, was whether, as Americans put it, these societies needed to punish their junta leaders and others all the way down the chain in order to become democratized. And at that time, in the memorandum I wrote for the CFR workshop group that was led by Ken Maxwell at the time that focused on Latin America, my sense was that there were alternatives and that it was something that needed to be engaged with in the region, and listed a bunch of alternatives that then became my book once I was able to go to Eastern Europe and follow those transitions. So this debate grew out of the debate at the time seemed to be at once a function of the legacy in the Southern Cone, very affected by German theorists, the inheritance of the post-World War II legacy of prosecutions, and yet at a time when the judiciary and other institutions were highly compromised. The takeaway at that time seemed to be that, yes, there was a role for a legal regime, and that in many ways the law played a role in constituting the transition, but that that it operated very differently in different places, and what amounted to legitimacy really was going to depend on both political context, legal traditions, and other cultural traditions and other questions. So fast forward the last 15 years, and how might we think about that inheritance of the institutions and norms, particularly human rights and humanitarian norms, that were an inheritance of the post-war period, and then the reflections that have come out of the last 2 decades. Well, here I want to suggest that we're in a different phase, and that the way transitional justice terminology is used, the actors involved, the questions, and in particular the way we might think about balance of these various different interests and aims reflects a globalization and of course a complex set of resolutions that we might learn more about in the 3 days to come. So what might be seen as the dimensions of this global phase? Well, first, what I've referred to elsewhere as steady state transition. which is a more pervasive view of conflict, a normalization of these questions. In particular, the switch from interstate wars to internal conflict, civil wars. If you add the war on terror and counterterror, occupations throughout Middle East and other parts of the world. So this sense of the pervasiveness of the problem risks a real change in our understanding of the word transitional and the conception of transitional justice. So a normalization, a move, if you will, from the exception to really the norm. The second part of it is the actors involved, and these we might think of as a shift from a purely statist debate, as it was encountered in the Southern Cone at the time that I started following East Europe and South Africa, really a determination made within state borders to a beyond the state mode. And here we see a great plethora of actors from the state itself to higher up regional actors, institutions, tribunals, and other entities, to international, of course, the UN, but also subnational, lots of other local actors, the role for civil society, an interest in the production of transitional justice and the usefulness of such a discourse in civil society. So a real multi-layered approach to the relevant actors, and of course, the third point would be that they bring with them and are advocating for a broader array of aims and have different interests. And this goes to the question which we'll take up a bit later on, but I want to shift to very soon, which is what the question of what modalities are appropriate for transitional justice and what and how we evaluate whether there's a success story or a failure really becomes very complex and quite difficult given the various actors involved. So if we think now about that historical punishment impunity debate and what that's given rise to, I think, the usefulness or not of this framework would become clear, which is that, at the time when one was thinking about the role of law and the role of accountability, this was being debated within state borders, and one could look to the question of the legitimacy of the judiciary, the role of advocates, the tradition, the legal tradition in that country. But now we might think of, for example, moving along in time to the prosecutions for ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, right, and the role of a regional tribunal. How might we think about it? The role of law concerning the genocide in Rwanda, areas that that Phil and others in the room have spent more time on. And here, one cannot help but conclude that these experiments have mixed results, but the question really is, what is the focus, right? And what we've seen is, on the one hand, an anxiety about the limitations of regional actors given state-centric interest, but that if we shift the focus and we move from beyond the state's interest and beyond a centricity on the state, then the questions about the anxieties and expectations about the tribunals become altogether different. So it really doesn't necessarily bring us closure, but it's a broader lens from which we might appreciate the impact of this trend of global justice. And this itself is being reflected normatively in the new institutions, legal institutions of the 21st century. So if we turn then to this, probably what is a symbol of this last phase, the ICC, we see there that there are a set of potentially conflicting values within the charter itself, where the goals range from justice to peace, where the subjects of the tribunal are stated as children, women, and men in that order, which tells us that there's a strong humanitarian dimension to the tribunal, and that we've really moved along to a role for law that it goes beyond justice and rule of law, some of the nominal aims of the middle period, to peace and security, human security in particular. So where does that leave us in this last phase? phase. If we think about some of the actors and this aim of and increasing references to transitional justice in post-conflict security frameworks, Secretary General Annan in 2004 talked about this role. The UN has a unit set up that aims at the role of transitional justice in security on the ground. Well, here we, of course, get into some very interesting questions, tensions, potential contradictions, and many of you who have done work in the field, I'm sure, can appreciate this better than others. So we see in Sierra Leone, Uganda, the DRC, the supposed role for transitional justice, sometimes at the end of conflict, but sometimes even in the midst of conflict. And this is, again, a departure from the aims of the law in the earlier period. Darfur, in particular, reflects this. And we can see some of the potentially competing aims of, on the one hand, humanitarian aims on the ground, and on the other, some of the aims of the Security Council, which ended up involving itself in an exceptional case of referral to the court. Let me turn in the remaining time to thinking a little bit about how we might think about the politics of this period, and then end with what the role of the scholars might be. So, we hear, very frequently, the demand for transitional justice, a claim that it can, in fact, almost perform the transition and even lead to security. Obviously, given this, a lens which focuses on a dynamic interaction of state and non-state actors, because the state hasn't withered away, although there is an increase in weak and failed states. And how we think of transitional justice also is distinctive from even the states that were engaged in these debates, such as South Africa and Latin America in the earlier period. How we might think about this, and given the role of the various actors, given the role of global civil society, really requires an empirical agenda. We see that transitional justice becomes more than anything almost a sphere of discourse within which, and now we might add another actor, which is peoples. Peoples' demands are being articulated. If we think about this in this way, why are there repeated emphasis of Turkish-Armenian genocide questions, and within Asia, lots of unresolved issues pertaining to peoples. And so transitional justice has become a space within which some of these demands are being articulated. And it leads to, of course, a very different appreciation of thinking about some of these issues than within the state-centric paradigm, where the question of what modality and what is to be done was really something that circulated around the state and its perspectives. So, we'll certainly want to focus on the research question, and I think prospectively of at what level should some of these decisions be made, and that, of course, will have the effect of keeping some actors out, and there will be political questions and a politics relating to that. Just by way of ending on the issue of this complexity that the global transitional justice framework implies. I've referred to really the steady state of it, which is a sense of ongoing conflict and institutions that are devoted to ongoing conflict, such as the ICC. A variety of different actors from global, international, transnational, regional, local, and civil society, and a variety of different aims, ranging from rule of law and justice to peace, human security, reconciliation, healing, truth, etc. The challenge then is how to confront this myriad of purposes normatively. We just left really in a state of chaos, scholarly chaos, practitioner chaos, are there significant questions and study to be done? Well, here, I want to raise a cautionary note, which is that there has been a challenge to this, really what appears to be, this broader array of questions that one might think of as a consulting model that, as Phil alluded to in his introductory remarks, really focuses on these questions in a more functional way or operative way. And here, we might think about three dimensions: a prescriptive, formulaic, managerial, and the role for experts. And what we hear in the midst of all of this complexity, normative complexity, is that there is an obligatoire, that there is a prescription, and that for countries in transition, political transition as understood in politics, or in a conflict, in a state of conflict or post-conflict. Well, how do these work in the Balkans, in Darfur? Very different scenarios than the statist illustrations is in the Southern Cone and in East Europe. And we're looking often at weak and failed states, situations of ongoing conflict, and it becomes very difficult to reconcile that the statist model and advice with those examples of instances of conditions of transitional justice in the global phase. But there is an appeal to that idea of prescription. To the idea of prescription, one ought might think about balancing normative complexity, the various aims and purposes associated with diverse actors, a diversity which ultimately can only be resolved through politics. A second point would be to the notion of a managerial approach. Again, this idea needs to be elaborated more. Why management is this notion that there's a problem that needs to be resolved and as quickly as possible, expeditiously. And here we might think about contrasting this or balancing this with an awareness of the role for interpretation in globalizing law and politics, and that if we're thinking about multi-layers and many different levels at which these decisions are being made, an awareness of a mix of tribunals, of cross-judging, and that often these competing resolutions, even with complementarity, can only be resolved with interpretation. And so the significance then of thinking about that in balancing it with this appeal of the managerial model. Finally, the question of expertise, which often comes up with the issue of the field, and how should we think about the road ahead of knowledge and understanding here. And often the claims to expertise sound in a science, a scientific mode. What sort of science is this? It needs, and certainly was alluded to in the introductory remarks, to be balanced against the kind of work that folks in the room are doing, the importance, complexity of context, not just as something that's added later, right, tweaking the template at the edges, but rather to seriously engage with and recognize the importance of the particulars of the various regions we're talking about, of the various questions, the differences between the various political scenarios, and ultimately this will inform the political resolutions that need to be made.
Great. Thanks very much, Rudy.